Please welcome the SDPA Fall Conference Medical Director, Dr. Heather Goff, to the stage. Dr. Goff is an associate professor in the Department of Dermatology at UT Southwestern Medical Center. She is a recognized leader in dermatology student education, training the next generation of dermatologists. She majored in fine arts in undergrad and still does pottery as a hobby.
All right, I still do pottery as a hobby, that's correct. Today, I'm talking on a variety of subjects. And so the other hat that I wear at UT Southwestern, besides doing work in cutaneous lymphomas, is an extremely disparate area of dermatology, although probably through this talk you'll see that there's some overlap, is that I direct the resident education in cosmetic dermatology, and I do 2 half-days a week of cosmetic derm with our residents. So the disclosure here is that many of the treatments and uses of some of these cosmetic agents are considered off-label, but I do think that these are important concepts to understand, and they're important for what we can offer to our patients. So one of the things that I always think about in medicine, both in science and basic science research and in clinical practice, is that, you know, we sort of have, if you think about like the sphere of what we have, and I think in dermatology, we're particularly experts because we have so many diseases that are extremely rare for which there aren't any FDA-approved indicated therapies and treatments. And so I think we are more comfortable than, say, like a cardiologist who is operating almost purely off of algorithm. But we treat rare diseases. And so one of the things that I think is very unique, and I think this holds true in cosmetic derm, is that there's sort of this known sphere of comfort of what we can do. But I think where we really advance the specialty is when we understand where our boundary is and we understand how to sort of gently push or nudge at the edge of that boundary to kind of explore and discover new options. Because otherwise you're just sort of recreating what's already been known, what's already been done. But when new drugs come on board or new therapeutic interventions arise, I think it's useful to sort of think about creative ways that we can utilize those and employ those in our toolkit. So these are some of the controversies that I wanted to discuss, because these are things that I got trained when I was in residency as sort of like, these are hard and fast rules. These are rules you just do not break. But it turns out you can actually break most of these rules. And when you start to look at the literature, you can actually break pretty much all of them. So the first one is that you shouldn't do filler on patients with connective tissue disease. The second being you shouldn't do resurfacing on patients that have taken isotretinoin in the past 6 months. That chemical peels should be avoided in patients that are using topical retinoids. You shouldn't do hair removal for someone who experiences paradoxical hypertrichosis or has untreated PCOS, that if you're going to do laser hair removal, you have to treat their PCOS or you won't have successful hair removal. Or if they paradoxically become hypertrichotic, you shouldn't continue to do laser hair removal. That you shouldn't use retinoids in rosacea, and that microneedling will help stria. So at the end of this lecture, I think you'll be able to sort of comfortably know which of these controversies you can break and which of these may actually be true. So controversy number one, you shouldn't do filler on patients with connective tissue disease. I was taught this when I was initially in practice. When we would screen a patient to do fillers, we had a little questionnaire, and if they checked that they had lupus or scleroderma or morphea or any other autoimmune disease, we automatically were like, no, I'm sorry, we really can't do this, or maybe neocollagenesis, and we don't want to do that in a patient with scleroderma. We may provoke your disease. That actually turns out not to be true. The use of hyaluronic acid-based fillers in patients with autoimmune inflammatory disorders like scleroderma and lupus, it is still controversial. The thought is that in inflamed tissues, you can propagate an inflammatory response and potentially promote reactivation of the underlying disease. So for this reason, a lot of specialists still say you shouldn't do these. But if you look at, cosmetic derm people, I think it gets a little bit of a bad rap in the sense that people think of it as just sort of like fluff and like not really alleviating suffering. We're just trying to make sort of already beautiful people even more beautiful. But to me, cosmetic derm really offers an opportunity, especially when it's applied for medical conditions. This is an extremely physically disfiguring and debilitating condition to have localized morphia on the face. This woman can't go out in public without people looking at her and wondering, you know, like what happened to her face. And if we can, you know, you can imagine that if she sees various dermatologists and says what can be done, and they find out she has morphia, and then basically everyone refuses to treat her, she's now going to live with this disfiguring condition for the rest of her life. But if you're like, okay, I have a spirit of adventure, we'll try this out and see how it does. And then, you know, of course, counseling and consenting the patient, saying we don't know if this may provoke your underlying connective tissue disease, but I think it's worth trying. And it turns out that you can do hyaluronic acid fillers. I typically choose the non-Vicross fillers when I'm treating these patients. Fillers like Pure Restylane or Pure Juvederm or Juvederm Ultra Plus, but not the ones that begin with the letter V, because when they're Vicross, they may have more immunogenic properties, and they're also harder to reverse. So when you're choosing a hyaluronic acid filler for restoring a patient with a connective tissue disease, I would pick a standard HA, kind of first generation HA filler. The thought is that hyaluronic acid fillers also volumize, soften, and hydrate the skin by binding water, and it may stimulate some collagen production. And when you repeat HA fillers over time, you actually may need less over time because you're getting a little bit of more durable effect. And so the fibroblasts take on a more morphologically stretched shape and a more active phenotype with some neocollagenesis. I know this is not talking about filler with connective tissue disease, but this is a study where they actually looked at using Botox plus filler, using hyaluronic acid fillers plus Botox around the mouth, onal botulinum toxin. I think I'll say Botox if that's okay with you guys. It's easier. Around the mouth of a patient with scleroderma, and you can see that her overall cosmesis is improved. This was a study that will be coming out in next month's printed JAD, the Journal of the American Academy of Dermatology, that we did, showing that just perioral Botox alone can improve oral aperture in patients with scleroderma. But we'll get into a second other fillers that may even further improve perioral aperture. So here also, a patient with Perry-Romberg morphia, and where repeated injections, and you know, I know like you all may say, I was taught never to do filler in the forehead, but cautiously using a cannula, aspirating before injecting, and they actually did slow restoration. So they did like half of a cc at a time over 3 month intervals to finally restore this individual's forehead. And then this patient, you can see because of the binding down of the localized morphia on her chin, they did hyaluronic acid filler Voluma, plus they did fractional resurfacing on her over a series of 3 sessions. And you can see the nice cosmetic result at the end. So I've given a lot of thought to scleroderma, why they get digital ulcers, why they get this sort of taut appearance on the skin, and also why you get this sort of like, in the last slide here, that kind of like, like a dried apple kind of a look to the skin. And I have a personal theory as to why that is. I was actually talking with our dermpath yesterday, and there's not a lot written on this subject yet. But essentially what you see in scleroderma, you know, when you see always a schematic of the skin, the dermis is always drawn like it's like a flat, like it's a layer cake, like it ends in a flat layer. But the dermis is actually kind of intercalated through the fat, through like these fibrous strand septae. So the dermis sort of interdigitates through the fat. And likewise, the fascia that overlies the muscle also interdigitates through the fascial planes with the dermis. So there's sort of this like connective tissue network. And if you think about part of what improves like the tensile strength of our skin is that it has the ability to withstand shear forces. It wiggles and it moves. It's not fixed to the muscle below it. Muscle is not very pliable. Fat is extremely pliable and wiggly. So, you know, it's like if you were trying to if you've ever tried to nail something on a pillow and it just doesn't work because it's too soft underneath. So you can't really break the skin or tear the skin or get an ulceration in the skin when you have a nice fatty cushion underneath. But when you essentially get inflammation along these kind of fascial strands and dermal strands, you essentially induce some neocollagenesis, and the skin essentially almost ends up becoming tethered to the muscle below it. And now you've lost all the pliability and the ability of the skin to withstand shear forces. So that's part of why I also think that fillers are useful in these patients, because you actually are restoring a little bit of this cushiony barrier between the dermis and the muscle. So a more novel approach, and I'm starting to try and talk with some of our plastic surgeons who are hand surgeons, is the use of autologous fat grafting. So for those of you who may work in offices or have close relationships with plastic surgeons, and you want a patient to really have good cosmetic result and also potentially improve, this is very novel and very new, but they're looking at doing autologous fat grafting in the digits of patients with scleroderma, which you may think, my goodness, we couldn't do such a thing, but you're actually improving the ability of the digits to bend and move and have pliable strength. And this is showing sort of at baseline, this dry, desiccated ulcer. This is 1 month post autologous fat. You can see healthy granulation tissue. And I think this is at 3 months after autologous fat grafting. And so this is sort of how I have the article here listed below, but the fat was essentially grafted near the avoiding the neurovascular bundle at the base of each finger, injecting about half a cc to one cc on each side of each finger with about 10 cc's per hand. And you can see that long-term results over time. I think this was like over a one-year interval after autologous fat that this patient has no longer any digital ulcers. So I think this is really profound and something that will probably end up becoming a game changer in the treatment of our patients with scleroderma. So I showed you after I read this article, I was like, wow, our Botox results weren't that exciting. But this is autologous fat. In the same study that they published, this was the injection technique. The gray zones indicate where the cannula was inserted, and the kind of yellow zones indicate where filler or autologous fat was placed. But this is showing at like 6 months post autologous fat grafting in the perioral region in two patients with scleroderma, the improvement in their overall oral aperture. And I think, again, what's happening is that you're creating that slippage plane where the skin can now glide around the muscle below it. And that improves the oral movement and the oral aperture and improves overall cosmesis. So controversy number two, you shouldn't do resurfacing on patients that have taken isotretinoin in the past 6 months. Just by show of hands, and it's totally fine if you've been counseling people, but how many people were taught that when they were in their training? If you had isotretinoin, you have to wait at least 6 months before you can do any kind of laser procedure. I was definitely taught that, and I've been telling patients that up until about 5 years ago. So it turns out there was a consensus document that just came out by a bunch of dermatologic surgical and cosmetic experts on what procedures are safe. It's an open access article. I'll show you that in a second. But the notion about isotretinoin causing abnormal scarring was actually based on studies from the 1980s. So if you guys know anything about laser history, this and like resurfacing history, the way they used to resurface patients in like the 80s and 90s was really, really kind of barbaric. Has anyone ever seen original CO2 in the room? Just by show of hands also, I'm just sort of curious. If you've seen it, tell the other people at your table what it's like. I saw one case when I was a resident back in the early 2000s, and I remember being like, oh my gosh, you're basically it's like resurfacing a road. You're basically like, we're gonna burn all of your skin off And then you're going to re-epithelialize from your hair follicles. And we're going to hope that we didn't get past the level of the sebaceous gland, because if we do, you're basically going to turn the face into scar tissue. And that's, and so it was a month. They had to have IV sedation and anesthesiologists in the room, you know, kind of giving the patient, you know, systemic anesthetic, and then you're basically burning off their skin, and then they leave the clinic kind of mummified. But this concept was based on three case series from the 1980s that only had 11 patients in them, and they showed that they had delayed healing and keloid formation following mechanical dermabrasion in 10 patients, and there was only one patient that had laser treatment, and that was an argon laser, which is also a super old school and less targeted laser. And so basically the recommendation sort of became like, well, it's prudent to just sort of like wait to postpone all surgical procedures in any retinoid patient until the retinoids have had a chance to subside. And so that was deemed to be a period of at least 6 months before you could undergo any kind of treatment. So this is the article. If you want to just Google or kind of like take a screenshot of that article, if you're ever looking at like, hey, I have a patient, they're on Accutane, they're asking me, or isotretinoin, what can they do? They're asking you, you know, I've had patients that I'm treating and they're like, I wanted to get laser hair removal and they're telling me I can't get it while I'm on this. Or I wanted to get radiofrequency microneedling. They're telling me I can't do it until I'm not on the isotretinoin. And I just Google this article and send them the link because it's free text. It's an open access article. And it's a consensus document, and you can see the number of authors that came together, and then they had their level of recommendation. So they essentially deemed that there was insufficient evidence to delay fractional ablative or non-ablative laser procedures. Fully ablative are not recommended. So basically, don't go burning someone's whole skin off. Don't do fully ablative laser treatments, but you can do fractional treatments, particularly at lower fluences and lower energy. So here was a study where they actually did a split face study. The upper photo, and you're thinking, okay, this girl looks good. The upper three photos look a little better, I think, than the lower three photos. And it turns out this is the split face study. The upper photos were actually laser resurfacing that was done at low fluence, 15 millijoules, and a density of 15%. So it was a really low density, low fluence, but this was done during the course of treatment of isotretinoin, and then this was the delayed treatment. And you can see that in the delayed state, the patient actually had a worse outcome. So they're actually, I would argue, there's not only no indication to delay, there's actually possibly an indication to treat while on therapy using conservative settings. So the global acne severity score was actually significantly lower on the side treated during the treatment versus the delayed laser treatment. So this is just showing a comparison of fractional, non-ablative fractional, ablative fractional, and fully ablative fractional during isotretinoin on test spots. And you can see this is why the consensus argument is that you should not do laser resurfacing that's fully ablative during treatment with isotretinoin, but non-ablative fractional and ablative fractional are considered relatively safe. And you can just look up articles and find what energy would be done during that course of treatment. So also, how many of you, I know up until like probably the last 5 years, we used to tell patients, you know, it's probably better if they, you know, they send us a little MyChart or a patient message through the portal. Hey, I'm coming in for my chemical peel in 2 weeks. Should I be stopping my Retin-A cream before I come in, blah, blah, blah. And you know, we always are like, yeah, you know, go ahead and stop it for at least a couple of weeks. But if you actually look at what do retinoids actually do, retinoids, when you use them, they're changing basal keratinocyte expression. Think about the, and so what happens is that your keratins 1 in 10, those are like your mature, durable keratins of the stratum corneum, they turn more into like keratins 5 and 14. That's why when you use a retinoid, you have that high proglow, because you get rid of all that dead keratin 1 in 10, you get this more mucosal keratins 5 and 14. And that takes like a month to take effect. So if you're really gonna be like, you have to stop your retinoid, it really needs to be at least for a month to have one life cycle of your skin. So 2 weeks is really would be considered insufficient. But should we even be telling patients to stop chemical peels? The answer is also probably not. So this was looking at treating patients using isotretinoin and salicylic acid versus oral isotretinoin alone. And you can see that the severity score of acne, the red line indicates patients that were getting salicylic acid peels during the course of treatment with oral isotretinoin. And then this study, there's actually very little written on this subject. So when I was trying to find articles on, there's really not any evidence out there on why would you delay. Essentially what you want to know is that the patients will experience a stronger reaction to any chemical peeling agent because they don't have those durable keratins 1 in 10, but they may get a more even peel and a more even frosting and a more even reaction. But you're going to be more conservative in your application and watching for those endpoint reactions and doing glycolic acid peels, sort of the erythema that might develop, or in TCA peels, the frosting that you see develop. So there was one study that I could find on using tretinoin doing TCA peels in the setting of someone using tretinoin. So this was looking at older male patients that were treated with a pretty aggressive 35% TCA peel. This is essentially going to almost a medium depth. And in patients that were treated beforehand with, they did a split face. So they applied the tretinoin to one half of their face and not to the other. And you can see that the half of the face that was treated with tretinoin had a greater frosting, but also had a more even frosting. Whereas the side that wasn't treated with tretinoin had a less even frosting and a lower grade of frosting. But what was the healing time afterwards? The tretinoin side actually healed faster. And that might have to do with some of the neocollagenesis, the improvement in cell turnover. For that reason and for this study, I don't necessarily always recommend for patients to stop retinoids before doing a chemical peel. But when I perform a chemical peel on these patients, I understand I'm going to reach my endpoints more quickly and more easily. And so I want to be more cautious in my application of a peeling agent. Okay, so what about doing laser hair removal in someone who has paradoxical hypertrichosis or has untreated PCOS? That actually turns out not to be true as well. Are you guys noticing a theme here? You can do all these things. There was a reduction in patients that had just idiopathic hirsutism versus PCOS. There was a greater overall response rate in hair severity scores in patients that just had idiopathic hirsutism versus PCOS. But overall, the PCOS group also had a reduction. So there was a 70% reduction in hair severity in the idiopathic hirsutism group, but only a 54% reduction in patients that have PCOS. But having PCOS itself is not reason to delay or counsel a patient to wait on doing laser hair removal. So if you have a patient that's like, I've got PCOS and I've got all this facial hair and I'm really disturbed by it, again, what I look at is that one of my jobs in life is to educate my patients and to alleviate some of their suffering. I know if I had a lot of facial hair and I had the means and the wherewithal to undergo laser hair removal, and then someone was like, now you have to jump through a hoop and see like an endocrinologist and an OBGYN and do all of this before we'll ever even start doing laser hair removal on you. I'm just delaying their, because this is gonna be a year and a half, 2 year long process. You're not gonna get rid of their hair in one laser treatment session. So I don't want to further delay by 3, 4, 6 months to start their laser treatments. I will counsel them. You may have not as durable results. You may end up needing more treatments over time. You aren't going to respond as well as someone who doesn't have PCOS. Getting your PCOS treated or addressed is going to help reduce your likelihood for recurrence, and it's going to improve your overall response rates. But I look at drugs that we prescribe very routinely in dermatology, like spironolactone, which is commonly used to treat PCOS. And I often myself, because I prescribe those medications, so I'm like, you know, you really need a relationship with an OBGYN to address your PCOS issues. But if you have no plans for reproduction at any time in the near future, I'm happy to start you on some spironolactone at the time that we're starting your laser hair removal. So patients had marked results and good responses, even in the setting with PCOS. So again, this was looking at, they followed actually patients just with PCOS and separated them out from a group of patients that had just standard hair, laser hair removal. And what they showed was that there also their hair reduction was improved. The mean session number was highest in the facial region. Most patients underwent, and this is a question a lot of patients will ask, and if you don't do laser hair removal frequently, that many patients will still ask you, oh, well, how many treatments am I gonna need? I usually tell people somewhere between 6 and 10, and it turns out that that's pretty accurate. That's based on some studies that were published in the past. But for PCOS patients, the facial treatment region was treated about 9, almost 10 sessions. Whereas other body areas like the legs, armpits, arms, inguinal areas were treated an average of about 6 sessions. And they had an overall reduction in their hair severity. And there was a positive correlation. So the more sessions that they do, the overall reduction was greater. So the more they did, the more they improved. And then the other interesting thing is that we always counsel patients about 6 to 8 weeks between sessions, but the interval didn't seem to affect so much the outcome of the patients. So it was just the overall treatment number. And so one of the things that you may want to counsel with your patients who are undergoing laser hair removal is that once they start seeing or feeling enough hairs that they feel like they can schedule another appointment. Schedule one for 6 to 8 weeks, but if they aren't seeing or feeling very many hairs yet at that time, to maybe push that out by another week or two or another month, because timing is less important than the overall number of treatments. So should we be using retinoids in rosacea patients? If you just Google rosacea and tretinoin, you're gonna find a whole lot. I just Googled this for the purpose of this talk. This was on a website called Real Self, and there was this woman who posted her own selfies, and she's like, hi, I've been using, you know, it's like one of these forums where people can write in their question. Hi, I've been using tretinoin once a week for the past 3 weeks. I think I used to have rosacea. These are photos of my skin now. I used it 3 days ago. It was the third application. I'm now getting red bumps. My skin used to be flawless, just a little pink in the cheeks. Should I stop using it now? I was planning to use tretinoin in the winter, starting it once a week for 3 weeks, then twice a week, et cetera. And so then some of the people answering her said, using tretinoin can worsen rosacea simply because it's just too harsh. Even some without rosacea, tretinoin can prove to be too powerful. One concern with using tretinoin to treat rosacea and any resurfacing product is the effect it can have on delicate skin barrier. Studies have shown that those with rosacea have a profoundly compromised skin barrier function, which makes harsh exfoliation with rosacea a bad idea. I don't disagree fundamentally with anything that's being said here, but I also think it's important to know that it's not, we say these things like they're hard and fast rules, but there's always a little bit of gray zone. So now we'll talk about the gray zone. Do you guys recognize this name, Dr. Kligman? Okay, so Dr. Kligman invented, you guys have all used Triluma, or essentially that's the Kligman's formula. So Dr. Kligman was he's not alive anymore, but old school dermatologist from University of Pennsylvania, like the original dermatology program in the United States. And he actually studied, this is like one of the only articles I could find on topical tretinoin for rosacea. And I just love the way he wrote this article, so I'd like copied and pasted a whole bunch of the text from it because I just love the way that he wrote it. And basically he wrote, topical tretinoin has apparently not been tried for rosacea. There's two reasons. First, comedones are lacking in rosacea. Secondly, rosacea patients are flusher blushers whose skin is sensitive. So this is all known way back in the, you know, what was this, 1993 when he wrote this article. Whose skin is unusually sensitive to a variety of contactants, including soaps, fragrances, and sunscreens. They have stinging and burning and itching from mild irritants to which normal individuals do not react. They also have an exaggerated response to vasodilators like nicotinates and alcoholic drinks. We, too, have been reluctant to use tretinoin in rosacea because subjective neurosensory reactions to stinging and burning are commonly experienced, sometimes accompanied by scaling and redness. But he was like, but we went on to do this. We gave the rosacea patients 0.025 tretinoin for 6 to 12 months. This dose was surprisingly well tolerated, with only one dropout after 2 weeks. Although the response was slow, half the subjects achieved nearly complete clearance and persisted for 6 months after stopping tretinoin. An unexpected and unprecedented finding was lessening of erythema and partial response to disappearance, partial to complete disappearance of the telangiectasia. Most patients did experience varying degrees of stinging and burning in the first few weeks, sometimes with aggravation of the erythema and variable scaling. Dry skin was a frequent complaint. Three patients had an exacerbation of pustules during the first month. This was generally, there was generally no improvement in the first month to month and a half. And I think about a lot of the clinical trials that, you know, are out there and that have been done now. And they're done, I mean, patients, a lot of patients now, I mean, you guys are using all the new biologics for psoriasis. And, you know, I know all of us, I want quick results. My patients want quick results. And so you're doing a lot of hand-holding here. So I'll tell you what I would do in my approach in just a second. But this can be a difficult study. You're like, oh my gosh, you're not necessarily better. You may be actually worse. You're a little bit more red. You're getting pustules in the first 4 to 6 weeks. You know, a lot of people, and it's like the first patient that I showed you where they Googled and, you know, sent into this Real Self website, and people are like, yeah, oh, you better stop that terrible tretinoin. It's really tearing you up. You're a rosacea sufferer. You shouldn't be using that stuff. Well, is that really the answer? So a modest benefit was evident by the end of 2 months, but not in everyone. But this was not encouraging. However, it was emphasized to patients that in the treatment of photoaging, the clinical response is usually unusually slow, and patients would eventually be rewarded. This turned out to be a valid judgment. By 4 months, about 70% of patients experienced satisfactory remission, with an unmistakable reduction in the density of papulopustules. This is the synopsis. After 6 months, 10 of 18 patients were cleared or nearly so. Six showed good improvement. In two patients, the response was only partial. No patient was worse or unchanged. Of the patients who were cleared at 10 to 12 months, six stopped using and remained cleared. And then, I loved this part, others could not be persuaded to stop the drug, declaring that the treatment was the most effective of the various topical agents that they had tried. What especially was remarkable and certainly unanticipated was a noticeable decrease in the persistent erythema and flushing episodes in most patients. So I think that a lot of what's happening in these rosacea patients, when you're using a retinoid, it's not that retinoids are completely off limits and shouldn't be used. You are going to stimulate, and rosacea is a photo-exacerbated dermatosis. So it's very important to spend a lot of time talking about sun protection and things to eliminate UV damage. But we can also do things to reverse some of that UV damage. And retinoids are one of our best defenses in that armamentarium. Then there was a study actually comparing the use of adapalene versus metronidazole gel for the treatment of rosacea. This study only went out over 12 weeks. But you can see that there were actually similar response rates of adapalene gel to metronidazole in terms of clearance of the number of papules, but the change in telangiectasia was no different in the adapalene versus the metronidazole group, or at least not necessarily significantly so. But you do wonder if over time you may have seen more improvement in the adapalene group. So what's my conclusion about tretinoin and rosacea? I think you can use retinoids in patients with rosacea, and they're probably part of a useful piece of our treatment tools for rosacea. But patients need to know that they may initially flare, but long-term improvement may take 4 to 6 months to see. And there may be more coaching that's needed in the early stages of use. And then the long-term effects of retinoids on photoaging and a need for using it long-term needs to be discussed. So this is my conclusion number two. In general, I really do love retinoids. I especially love tazarotene. I can't like talk enough about how much I love tazarotene. I think it gets a bad rap as being the most irritating of the topical retinoids. I think that retinoids are a little bit like statins. You know how you hear people go, you know, oh yeah, I got all this muscle pain with the statin, but then I tried a new one and I didn't have that muscle pain. I kind of think of retinoids like the same. I think that sometimes in dermatology we're too quick to sometimes abandon retinoids, where it's like, oh, that tretinoin, it really messed me up. Okay, well, let's try adapalene. Okay, well, that didn't work, let's try tazarotene. I personally use tretinoin and my face looks like it's falling off. I can use tazarotene almost like it's water. So I really truly believe that everybody responds to topical retinoids differently, and different retinoids act differently in different people's skin. And so if one causes an adverse reaction, try another. Try mixing it with a moisturizer. Try sandwiching the retinoid in with a moisturizer. And I put this picture in here because I actually show this picture to a lot of my patients in clinic when I'm trying to convince them to use a retinoid, both for photoaging and for other purposes, is I'm like, I'm going to give you the best anti-wrinkle cream that money can buy. There's a lot of anti-wrinkle creams out there. This one, you may have to spend money out of pocket. You know, it's a lot of my middle-aged women. They don't have acne. It's not an FDA-approved indication. They're going to have to use a discount prescription program to probably get their medication. But this is a patient of mine who has gotten Botox. So you know, her glabellar furrows have improved over time with repeated episodes of using Botox. She gets it about every 4 months or so. But this is her after starting tazarotene, 0.1% cream, and she does it like Monday through Friday, and she uses it with a moisturizer. So she sort of sandwiches with a moisturizer. But you can see that this is her over time, and you look and you're like, well, you know, this, when I show it to patients, I go, which one do you think she looks older? And of course everybody's like, she looks older there. And I'm like, she's 7 years older here than she is here. So she's actually almost a decade more aged in this photo than she is in here. And the only thing that she's doing is tazarotene. We haven't done chemical peels. We haven't done anything else. She has done no resurfacing lasers. I've been treating her for a long time. This is just the results of a topical retinoid and sunscreen. So doing pulse dye laser and microneedling to treat stria. So this is a study looking at microneedling to treat stria. They reported that they thought there was some improvement. And I agree, maybe there's a really subtle improvement in this upper photograph. There's a little bit of crepiness here that you don't see necessarily here, and maybe a little bit of decrease in the width of some of these stria here compared to there. But to me, these results from microneedling, this is after three sessions, are a little bit not, they're kind of meh to me, sorry. They did have a, like, per their study protocol, it was improved. This is a comparison of an ablative fractional erbium YAG versus the pulse dye laser. And so here on the left photo, this is the pulse dye laser, and this is the erbium YAG. That's the resurfacing laser. And then over here, it's actually the reverse. It's the erbium YAG versus the pulse dye laser. So to me, I think you can see this picture speak for themselves. The fractional resurfacing erbium YAG is a little bit more effective. But this was after five sessions of erbium YAG, and the other was after three sessions of erbium YAG, the results of the before and after. But I do think that you see better results in the erbium YAG versus pulse dye laser to treat stria. And then this is comparison of microneedling versus a Decadot CO2 resurfacing laser. And there, I think if you look at the before and after of just, this is kind of like a, not a radio frequency, but just sort of like a skin pen or regular standard microneedling with four sessions done 1 month apart at a 2.5 millimeter depth. I also think these are a little bit sort of meh to me, meh results. So the reason I'm showing you these pictures isn't to like bash on microneedling or to bash on like resurfacing or to bash on treating stria. It's to say that you can get results. But if you're going to get results for stria and patients are really bothered by their stria, go for a fractional ablative laser, like an erbium YAG or a fractional ablative CO2, if you're going to really optimize your results, and that you're going to have to probably do 3 to 5 sessions to see more substantial results. And then also counseling the patient and maybe even showing them, take screenshots of these pictures or Google the article and find the photos online of the before and after, that like, this is a big cost. You know, every office charges differently, but let's say pulse dye laser. To me, if I'm gonna charge you $300 a session for microneedling, and at the end of 3 to 5 sessions, you're gonna spend $900 to $1,500 worth of treatment, you better be like, that was totally worth my $1,500 or totally worth my $900. And if they don't feel like that, if they're looking and they're like, wow, I just don't see, this doesn't feel like $1,500 worth of results to me, I think that, to me, that says a lot. And so if you're gonna spend money on something that's going to make a more substantial clinical result. And so, again, here, this is looking at microneedling versus the fractional erbium YAG. The upper photo is the fractional erbium YAG, and then the bottom is 6 sessions of a radio frequency microneedling. I think these both had relatively decent results, and they were both over 6 sessions. So again, with these patients, you have to counsel them. It's gonna take 3, 5, 6 sessions. It's gonna be this amount of money to get the results that you need, but if you're going to do it, do something that's ablative and is going to use some heat in the skin. So I'm wrapping up a little bit early, so you'll get to go to lunch early, but I hope that what you take away from this talk is that you can do filler on patients with connective tissue disease. I really think autologous fat is going to be a game changer in patients with scleroderma, particularly for hands and digital ulcers. If you can find a hand surgeon that is willing to do that and you treat those patients, I think it's something that's going to be much more worth exploring in the future. You can resurface patients that have taken isotretinoin in the past 6 months. There's actually a consensus document telling you all the procedures that you can do in the setting of isotretinoin. You should continue to do laser hair removal in someone experiencing paradoxical hypertrichosis or untreated PCOS because over repeated sessions, they actually improve. You can use retinoids and rosacea, and it's going to be part of the toolbox for treatment of rosacea. And that microneedling and pulse dye laser may or may not help stria, but the results may not be worth the cost to the patient. And so if you're gonna do resurfacing, go for an ablative treatment. That's all, thank you.